I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Kansas and Missouri are part of the heartland, and it can seem like the border with Mexico is a world away. Our connections, though, are a lot closer than they might appear. Today, find out why what happens on the border should matter to us in the Midwest. Then, small communities in rural America are used to seeing people move out and head to the city. Businesses close and Main Street gets boarded up. But we're going to hear about a few towns that hold out hope and maintain their resiliency. Bill Brownlee will take us out with this week's Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. When a lot of Americans think about this country's border with Mexico, the image often is anything but positive. Politicians talk about an endless flow of illegal immigrants. The president talks about building a border wall. There's a big buildup in border patrol forces these days. And there's also talk about illegal drugs and drug cartels. Those may be valid concerns, and there may be other ways at looking at this issue as well. We're about to find out. We're joined now by Raul Rodriguez. He's chairman of the board of the U.S.-Mexico Foundation in New York City and former president of the North American Development Bank. He has spent his career working on binational issues of one kind or another. He joins us now from KANU over in Lawrence. And Raul, welcome. So nice to have you here.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you for having me.
You're not crazy about how the Trump administration is approaching Mexico, and I'm wondering why.
Well, not exactly, although I do understand the concerns underlying his position. And these concerns have to do with the way that the job scene has evolved in the U.S. over the past few years. And so, again, it's understandable that there's a backlash against things that we don't know.
To what extent do you worry that Mexico is being tainted, in a sense, by our new president, negative image upon negative image, whether it's drug cartels, illegal immigrants, all this talk? What do you think about all that?
Well, the problem is that we haven't been exactly efficient in terms of portraying what happens with Mexico in the U.S., not only over the past couple of years or since November specifically, but over the past 25 years, where a lot of things have happened which are extremely positive. The story is not out. The narrative with regards, for example, to NAFTA, which has been the North American Free Trade Agreement, which has been very much at the hub, at the core of what has happened bilaterally, is not exactly prone to conveying the whole story, the positive story of the bilateral relationship and, again, how it has evolved over recent years.
And why isn't that more positive story coming forward? Because, again, we're not hearing that.
I think that to a certain extent, to put it mildly, the constituents of NAFTA, those who have been benefiting on both sides of the border, be that workers or employers, governments and so forth, took it for granted. I mean, we all thought, this is working, this is going okay. We don't need to promote the positive, the benefits. People will obviously notice, and that has not been the case.
In your view, and we'll talk more about NAFTA in a little bit, in your view, has the president softened his rhetoric now that he's been in office for a few months when it comes to Mexico or not?
Well, it depends on the tweet of the day, I guess. You never know. I guess in general that has been the case, at least in the case of NAFTA, which, again, I think is very much at the center of the bilateral agenda. I think we're hearing a much more rational approach. And as you know, yesterday, today and tomorrow, we have hearings in Washington, D.C., convened by the government. For the most, what I hear from cabinet officials, the highest levels of the administration, By the way, which are mostly, most of the members have done business themselves with Mexico the past few years and have benefited from NAFTA directly. What I hear is a lot more positive than what I heard early on in the administration.
How do leaders in Mexico regard President Trump?
Well, in general, I think there's a resentment in terms of the tone. And I don't think, for example, building a wall. We built a wall over the past 20 years. I mean, out of the 2,000 miles of border, about 770 or something of sorts have a wall already, which have been built over the past administrations. So that's not the issue. The issue is the tone, the way that it's been presented.
And what needs to happen with that tone, Raul? I mean, has that message been conveyed to him that the tone isn't appropriate for building the kind of constructive relationship going forward that might be beneficial to both sides?
You know, if you take 200 years of international bilateral affairs into consideration, You will find grounds on the Mexican side for some level of resentment. I mean, be that justified or not, Mexico lost 57% of its territory to the U.S. back in the mid-1800s. There was a war between 1846 and 1848. There was an invasion of Veracruz in 1914, and so on and so forth. So justified or not, There's a level of resentment in Mexico that is still alive in many ways. That had been toned down substantially because of the level of business, of positive business that's been going on for the past 25 years. The level of cooperation, which is unprecedented at many different levels, security, immigration, needless to say, economics. I'll just give you an example. El Chapo Guzman, who was the most sought-after narco lord in the world,
right.
He was extradited to the U.S. earlier this year. That would have been absolutely unimaginable 20 years ago. Impossible from a political standpoint in Mexico.
Because?
Things are happening. Well, because of sensitivities. I mean, it was an issue of sovereignty to begin with. Well, today that has been toned down, and we have a very productive relationship. I've been working from the business and academic standpoint in bilateral affairs for the past 30 years or more. And I had never seen this level of cooperation. It does not behoove us in the U.S. to tone that down. I mean, we need Mexico for a number of reasons. I'll give you one example. Most of the undocumented immigration by far today in the U.S. is coming from Central America. In the case of Mexico, net zero or negative, meaning we're sending more people back to Mexico than the ones who are coming here.
I did not know
passively.
That.
Yes. Yeah. That's documented, and you can add to that the number of apprehensions on the side of the Border Patrol. I mean, it's gone dramatically down in the case of Mexico. Well, in order to deal with the issues in Central America, which are not easy, you need Mexico's cooperation. In the absence of that cooperation, it becomes a lot more difficult for us to control, to stem that flow.
And yet then, Raul, our president continues to talk about building this wall, and not only that, making Mexico pay for that. How's that kind of rhetoric sitting amongst leaders in Mexico?
Well, the second part of the statement is still unclear. I mean, he hasn't spelled out how that's going to happen. The first part of the statement is, to say the least, insensitive. I mean, once again, we already have a wall in about a third or so, more than a third, of the length of the border. The part of the border that is more prone to crossings is already covered by a substantial amount of barriers, of physical barriers. Additionally, we have had over the years a very efficient expansion of technology all across the border, surveillance. So again, there's other ways to deal with that which are much more cost effective. I love a statement that my congressman, I live in San Antonio, Texas, Will Hurd, who is a Republican, very young, very bright. He spent 9 years at the CIA, working for the CIA. He's an expert in security. His business is security. And when asked about the wall, once again, this is a Republican, congressman, federal congressman, he said, this is a third century solution to a 21st century issue. Hmm. I fully agree.
Because, why is that?
Because of the cost effectiveness. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're left with the somewhere between 60 and 70% of the border that doesn't have a wall yet. You're left with the most expensive part of the border in terms of building some kind of physical barrier, number mm-hmm. one, with environmental issues, with a number of different issues, let alone sensitivities. Okay, I'm simply addressing the cost effectiveness of this. It just doesn't make sense. I wouldn't argue against building parts of the wall and some elements of the border, some parts of the border are still left. But once again, I mean, thinking of a 2,000-mile border covered entirely by a wall is just not efficient.
Again, Raul Rodriguez is my guest. He's chairman of the board of the U.S.-Mexico Foundation in New York City. He'll be talking about borderlands. Why should Kansans and Midwesterners care about the border at 3 o'clock this afternoon at the Dole Center of Politics over in Lawrence? Again, 3 o'clock today to hear Raul Rodriguez in Lawrence. You also said this notion, what else should Americans know about the border, Raul, that maybe they don't know or maybe they haven't thought about for a while?
Well, we don't think about the border. We don't think about Mexico altogether. And I'm saying this as a Texan. I mean, this is a state that sells more to Mexico than to the sum total of the following 16 customers abroad. Hmm. Meaning if you add China and Canada and 14 more, they don't add up to what we in Texas sell to Mexico. Hmm. But the same is true in Kansas. I mean, think of Kansas as if it were a business and you have sales abroad and you export $10 billion per year, which mm-hmm. is what actually happened last year. 20%, almost 20% of that, you sell to your main customer, meaning Mexico. Those sales last year increased 5%. Sales to number two and number three, Canada and China, decreased by 25%. And what you're selling to Mexico is not simply grains and meat, which is fine, it's wonderful. You're also selling aircraft and machinery and so forth. And the surplus that you have with Mexico is over $1 billion, meaning you sell more than you buy. In the case of China, the deficit that Kansas has with China is over $1.6 billion. Hmm. Hmm. So, you know, that simple contrast, if we were talking about a business, you would be taking care of that customer with all the lavishness that you can think of. I mean, at least in terms of trying to understand who that customer is and treating him in the right way in terms of priority, in terms of making sure that this is known and appreciated.
If our listeners want to call in with questions for Raul Rodriguez, they can do so right now, 816-235-2888. Again, 816-235-2888. Or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. So is it time to update NAFTA? Because a lot of experts say it is time for exactly that.
Oh, yes, by all means. I think that the way the pundits would put it, the economic architecture of the world has changed so much over the past 25 years. It's about time that we review not only NAFTA, but in general our agreements, our trade agreements with the world. The question is how. To begin with, rules of origin are needless to say, an important component that needs to be reviewed in terms of domestic content and our mutual exports. The e-commerce was essentially not in existence back then, so that's another element that needs to be somehow incorporated. Intellectual property rights is another topic that needs to be considered, needless to say. Energy is a new element in the equation that was not dealt with 24 years ago. The question is, how do you do it? And the question is timing. Mm-hmm. There's a presidential election coming up in Mexico in July of next year. We have midterm elections in November of next year here. what's called the fast track authority in the U.S. expires in July of next year. So we don't have that much time in terms of revamping NAFTA. If we leave it open and if it lingers, it's going to be Pandora's box. So my personal stand on this is let's do a quick review, the most urgent things, particularly those that don't need any kind of legislation that can be done by the governments of both sides. And do that within the calendar year, if possible. And then leave other more complicated things for maybe 2019.
How much interest is there in the approach you're suggesting here?
In the U.S.?
Yes.
I think substantial. And once again, I think we will be hearing this week and the hearings in D.C. By the way, there's not only a numerous participation there in terms of the stakeholders. There's also substantial public input in the hearings and in the preliminary discussions. I think there's substantial interest.
You know, again, one of the common thoughts in this country about NAFTA, so many people have a very quick reaction when they hear that acronym, and they immediately conclude that NAFTA has cost this country jobs. They've heard a lot of politicians, including our president, say that. What do you say to that?
Well, the most recent poll from any serious company came out from Pew a couple of weeks ago, and a majority of Americans believe that NAFTA has been positive. So, the story related to the fact that we all somehow reject NAFTA is not exactly accurate. Yes, there's opposition and there's concern, and as I mentioned at the onset, I think part of the reason is we don't have enough information out. In terms of what has affected jobs, there is net job creation because of NAFTA in the U.S. and in Mexico. In the U.S., it's somewhere in the range of 5 to 6 million jobs that today fully depend on NAFTA. And that is according to a number of different sources. There's additional sources that that allude to the fact that manufacturing, yes, has decreased, but it's decreased all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Right along those lines, Stephen from Overland Park has a question. Stephen, welcome to Up to Date.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Sure.
Raul, I had a question about automation. I was kind of interested on to know what Mexico's role with America as a trade partner would play with the rate of automation, just from the standpoint that America's going to be adding more manufacturing jobs possibly with, you know, automating different factories, and how Mexico would be able to keep up with the new technologies.
How's automation going to affect all this, Raul?
That's a huge challenge. In terms of job loss in manufacturing over the past 20 years, the estimate is that somewhere between 85 and 90% of job losses in the U.S. are directly related to automation and technology in general. Not to free trade or anything of sorts. Mm-hmm. It's automation, it's technology, it's new business models that have evolved over the years. I don't know if there's an echo or it's only on my side here.
You sound great on our end.
So I think we have to be very clear in terms of what's happening. Manufacturing overall in the world is decreasing in importance, particularly in developed countries. That's a fact. Now, the second part of the question is how do we evolve NAFTA so that we're better geared in terms of new trends in technology and manufacturing? That's part of what I was alluding to when I said that NAFTA was negotiated at a time when manufacturing was the name of the game. Mm-hmm. And for example, let alone high-tech and digital technology and so forth, we don't even have e-commerce considered in the agreement. So a revamping is called for. What's not fair is that we taint that renegotiation with all sorts of arguments that are not necessarily true.
Lynn tweeted us this, what happens when California cannot harvest our crops due to a lack of Mexican workers?
That's a big issue. Mm-hmm. About somewhere between 50 and 60% of our agriculture business in the U.S. Employs undocumented workers, not only from Mexico, but from all over the world. Bloomberg just came out with news about a couple of weeks ago from Kansas, from farmers here complaining about the same issue. It's not only California. So we need to be very efficient in terms of how we address these issues. The way I put it is we need some enlightened self-interest when addressing trade and immigration and security. Not simply, you know, parochial standings and negate what's happening in the modern world. I mean, we need to address a worker program, a temporary worker program with Mexico, and there's a very good proposal that's bipartisan in the U.S. and has Mexican input that was just published last year. Headed by a working group that had as co-chairs Carlos Gutierrez, who's our former Secretary of Commerce under George W. Bush, a Republican, former chairman of Kellogg Corporation, and Ernesto Zedillo, a former president in Mexico and today professor at Yale University. Very reasonable, very well crafted, 21st century version of what a temporary worker program should be all about, where you cover both sides of the equation. Number one, legal migration, temporary. People work and go back and come here as needed. And number two, covering the economic needs of our country, which are, I mean, you can't neglect the fact that we don't have the kinds of workers that we need for some sectors.
Do you sense that Congress, the tone in Congress, the atmosphere these days would is conducive to passing something like that?
Once again, 2018 is very complicated on both sides of the border.
Yeah. Elections, yeah.
Either we do it ASAP this year, which is difficult considering we're also opening NAFTA altogether. But I think 2019 is crucial.
Okay. Just a final point, Raul. To what extent is Mexico making progress against these drug cartels we hear so much about that are said to be still in control of some states in Mexico?
Extremely complicated. The amount of money that flows is just unimaginable. It's just huge, and dealing with that in a country that is not exactly at our level in terms of development, we're talking about a country that is 8 times smaller in terms of purchasing power parity and in terms of its economy, with regards to the U.S. So you can imagine that for a good number of small communities all over the country, as well as several areas of national politics, this is a tremendous issue in terms of a source of corruption. What's important here is for us to continue along the line that we've been building over the past 20 years, which is an approach that is based on shared responsibility. We can either simply say, you know, it's an issue of supply. Mexico is to blame, which is, number one, not exactly true. Number two, not conducive to anything positive. Or we can continue with that approach saying, well, this is shared responsibility. There's an issue here in terms of demand, in terms of distribution, as well, of course, as supply on the Mexican side. And we better deal with it together. And once again, the example that I gave in terms of the of El Chapo, of this drug lord, an important piece of the Sinaloa and other cartels in Mexico, being extradited to the U.S. And he's serving not in Almoloya, he's serving in Lower Manhattan in a high-security prison, which is obviously crucial to the whole idea of how do you solve the situation, is an example of the kind of progress that we've made over the years. Is it perfect? Is everything rosy? Of course it isn't. I mean, this is an extremely complicated situation. But again, having been a part of this over the past 20, 25 years in terms of the economics component of this relationship, I dare say that we have come a long way.
That's Raul Rodriguez, chairman of the board of the U.S.-Mexico Foundation. Again, he speaks at 3 o'clock this afternoon at the Dole Institute of Politics over in Lawrence. His topic, Borderlands, Why Should Kansans and Midwesterners Care About the Border? Raul, just a great conversation. Thanks so much for taking some time.
Thank you so much.
Time for a break here. When we come back, we'll take another look at small-town America. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we met UMKC's new women's basketball coach, and we learned about a nursing school set to open in Salina that could attract healthcare providers to rural Kansas. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. On tomorrow's program, from grilled fava beans to root beer ribs and ember-roasted Brussels sprouts, hear about some unique and downright unusual recipes just in time for your 4th of July cookout. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, when a lot of folks look at small-town America these days, they see towns decaying and people fleeing for the big cities. But when Julianne Couch looks at it, she sees hope and an unmistakable resiliency. She talks about it in a new book, The Small Town Midwest, Resilience and Hope in the 21st Century. In it, she chronicles her visits to 9 communities, including 4 in Kansas and Missouri. Julianne Couch once taught in the English department at the University of Wyoming. She had family here in Kansas City, and she joins us now. And Julianne, nice to have you. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Why are you so bullish on small town America? Because we just did a show yesterday discussing the nursing shortage in Kansas and Missouri, and we talked about many of the challenges that rural Americans face. And here you are giving us a whole different view.
Well, part of the thing, I guess, is because I live in one and I have to defend it to everyone that I speak with, because they'll say what you're saying, why on earth would you live there? And the other thing is that I'm just observing what small towns seem to mean to individuals who want to live in them or no longer live in them or wish they could. And even at the state government level and federal level, there are programs for rural residents, for rural development, program in Kansas to try to get people to return to the state and settle in a rural community, rural county. So it's obviously on the minds of lots of people to want to bring this rural living or rural communities and keep it solvent.
You know, it seems to me that people have two reactions about the idea of living in a small town. You just described one, people sort of recoiling and say, I could never live that far away from, you know, people and all the energy and everything else. But other folks look at it and they say, oh, geez, it'd be just great to live in a small town and get away from all the hustle and bustle. And, you know, there's a warm apple pie in everybody's oven every afternoon at 4 o'clock. And what did you find out there?
Well, those types of people that you were describing are mostly people who grew up in a small town and have left. Mm-hmm. I don't encounter many people who have never lived outside of a metropolitan area of any size who think, gee, I want to, you know, chuck it all and go to a town of 1,000 people that takes me an hour to get to a Walmart. Most people don't envision that with any sort of serious thinking. Mm-hmm. But I've met a lot of people both, you know, in metropolitan areas who grew up in a small town and desire to get back. And of course, I'm meeting people in small towns who desire to move to metropolitan areas, but many of them, including younger people, which did surprise me, there are a lot of younger people I am meeting, and I assumed that they would be on their way to the next city as soon as they could, but they want to make a go of this lifestyle.
Hmm. Does it take a certain kind of person to live in a small town? And do you notice, are there, this is a really too broad of a question, but are there certain characteristics that small town people have that big city people don't?
Probably not, but I can talk about what makes the small town, what kind of people a small town needs.
Sure.
And that is people who are actually, who notice that there's 2,000 other people around them and that they have to do their part. You can't live in a small town and disappear into the woodwork and then wonder why things are, you know, why isn't anybody running for city council? Why isn't anybody volunteering at the, you know, the town festival? You know, you cannot hide. It's too diluted for hiding. Whereas if you're in a city of a million people, so what? You don't go to your, you know, your church chicken supper that weekend. Who will notice that you're gone? You know, a few people. But your individual role makes so much more of a difference. That's a lot of pressure on one hand. But on the other hand, you know, small towns need everybody to really take a role. And yeah, and I think that maybe that answers that question that you posed in the way you posed it too, perhaps.
So in small towns, you're saying people notice when you don't show up for church on Sunday morning.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And it does have some pressure to it. Yeah.
It does have pressure. And if you are a person, and you know, lots of people choose to just not go to church. Lots of people don't have traditional inroads into meeting people in a small town. If you don't go to church, if you don't have children in the school, if you are don't work in a traditional job where you meet people every day, it can be very isolating. And so you have to find other ways to insert yourself, insinuate yourself into the culture of a community. And again, that's not easy for everyone to do, and that's not everyone's comfort zone.
Julianne Couch's new book, The Small Town Midwest, Resilience and Hope in the 21st Century. What did you set out to do here with this book, Julianne?
Well, two things, and I mentioned one already, is, you know, to explore what people are actually trying to do to reverse or at least stabilize the population loss and that's so affecting our rural communities and rural economies. But I chose to do that because I wanted to explore the places that I personally had been, because I realized that sort of the stretch of land between the Mississippi River, where I live now, and the Rocky Mountain area where I used to live, it's a pretty big area, sort of the Midwest and Great Plains area. And I thought, those are the areas I know. So Kansas, Missouri, Iowa, Nebraska, and then I tacked Wyoming onto the edge of that. So I wanted to really explore small towns, two per state, and explore them pretty carefully. And select towns that were maybe no more than 4,000 people, because, you know, you get a little bit higher than that and you're no longer technically considered rural. And so I wanted to just meet people, be able to tell their stories, and select towns based on a diversity of factors, so I wasn't telling the same story 9 or 10 times over, and present rural small towns and the people who live there as actual people with real lives and real challenges and real wonderful opportunities. And I hope that the towns I wrote about feel that I portrayed them fairly.
How did you pick the towns you did?
Well, really, literally, I pulled out a map and I thought I wanted geographic diversity. So, for example, in Kansas, I picked a town, Norton, out on the high plains of western Kansas.
Way up on the northern border.
That's correct. And then I picked Sedan down on the southern, southeastern corner.
Right.
So that is an area much more inflected by, you know, Oklahoma and southern Missouri. So culturally and economically very different than western Kansas, which is more Nebraska, Colorado, you know, western conservative type values.
You did the same thing in Missouri. You did Tarkio, way up in the northwestern corner of the state, which is so far from Kansas City. Then you picked New Madrid, way down in the southeast corner, down near Mississippi, right?
On the southern part of the Mississippi River. So basically, I live now in Bellevue, Iowa. So I am on the Mississippi River as far east as you can go. So I got in my car and I drove to all of these places that I visited and hung out there. So in Missouri, Tarkio, I chose in one part because it's the county that Atchison County is the county at the time that was losing population faster than any other county in the state. And also because growing up in Kansas City in a certain decade, I heard that song Tarkio Road and by Brewer and Shipley an awful lot. So I was sort of cognitively brainwashed by that, but I wanted to go there. And then I wanted to choose someplace very different. So New Madrid, Missouri is right down the Mississippi River from me, about 250 river miles. So I thought I wanted to, you know, look at another river town comparable to this and see what the differences were in, you know, that culture in that place.
Well, Tarkio was interesting because what you found there was a community that's still reeling from the closing of Tarkio College back in 1992. Tarkio is the home of Congressman Sam Graves, who represents the northern part of Kansas City as well. What did you find about Tarkio and how it's trying to deal with a loss that's now more than two decades old?
Well, by golly, they are sure gung-ho about not admitting any sort of defeat. And they've got a wonderful asset up there in that college, but nobody wants it.
Few people have talked about going there, but they just haven't pulled the trigger, right?
Right, right. It's, you know, just briefly what I was told is, and, you know, someone else might have more information, but they have this wonderful college, but not a wonderful place for college students, because what happens when you close a college is that you lose the businesses that cater to college students. So few college students want to go to a college in a place where they can't get some sort of a part-time job to help make ends meet. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of an imploding situation, but people are, you know, they've recently undertaken to demolish homes that had become blighted because of so many years of being vacant. Now they've got unblighted neighborhoods and can start from scratch. Many of us would feel that is sort of a depressing factor, mm-hmm. but for them, that's an accomplishment. That is an achievement. They can now no longer they don't have neighborhoods that are blighted anymore. They are doing some restoration on the campus. The Alumni Association is very active there in getting some things going, but it's just, you know, it's a formidable problem, mm-hmm. And people are nibbling at it instead of just saying, well, you know, I'm afraid that this is just not going to work for us. We're leaving. People are staying and nibbling.
Is anybody moving to Tarkio, Missouri?
Well, I don't have the current figures on that, I don't think, but I would doubt it. I mean, there's Tarkio and then, I'm going to zone out on the other communities that I wrote about, but they're just all right there in the county. Rockport is one. Mm-hmm. So, you know, people will work at the nuclear plant right across the river from Rockport in Nebraska and then decide where to live. And so they might choose Rockport or they might move one town over to Tarkio. You know, so people are much more apt to think, I will live near some place that I want to be rather than live in some place. Yeah. And, you know, they do in Atchison County, just a quick point, they really tout how fast you can get to Kansas City on I-29 for a job or how fast you can get to Omaha. You know, it's only one book on tape away to get to a job in Lincoln, you know. So they really say, you know, we're close, depending on how you define close.
Yeah, I just wonder what you found as you visited all these towns. You know, Julianne, this notion that the demographic trends in this country are unmistakable. The big cities are growing. Rural America is hollowing out. How much hope is there out there that folks in rural America can turn this thing around? You know, and just to add on to that, you know, once a year or so with some neighbors, my wife and I drive out into the Flint Hills. We just love it down there and drive around and stop at towns just hither and yon. And what you see, as much as you want to see towns that are capitalizing on the tourism of the Flint Hills, you see town after town that's just hurting in one form or another. Even Cottonwood Falls, which is sort of a bigger community right in the heart of the Flint Hills, has major struggles. I'm wondering, so where's the hope out there in rural America that somehow these trends are going to reverse?
I don't think that there's a trend reversal that's really the object of hope. I think it's a trend stabilization that our people are really going for.
But even that's a stretch, isn't it?
Right. Well, here's how they're approaching it. They're saying, number one, let's encourage our kids to go off in college and get educated someplace, but then encourage them to come back so that they can start their own businesses. So they're encouraging entrepreneurship. The other prong of that.
But kids aren't going to, most kids these days aren't going to do that either, are they?
Well, I can't speak for Cottonwood Falls or places like that specifically. I can speak for my own town of 2000. So yeah, most of the kids here do go off to college, but the difference is we are 20 minutes from Dubuque, Iowa. So I am 20 minutes from a town of 50,000. Cottonwood Falls and other places like that are not that close. So people can say, yes, I will come back to my small town now because I'm I'm ready to start a family. My parents are here.
Right.
I want my children to be raised in this environment where I was raised. I want my parents to be able to know my children. And my job is only a half an hour away up the interstate. So that's the kind of thing, the resilience
right.
that I'm using. That's how I'm thinking of it. It's the new normal that you're not going to have a town that's, you know, gaining 2 or 3 or 5% population every year. You're going to be lucky if it stabilizes where it is. And that's a generation or two more life for your town.
Let's talk about another one of these towns, Norton, Kansas, population 5671. You went there in part because you wanted to see how this town was reinventing itself in the era of automated farming.
Mm-hmm.
How are they managing that? What did you find?
Well, they have some stable employers. So they've got various sorts of manufacturing that hires quite a few people, and they are sort of the community, they are the hub in that region. So they might not be doing great, but they're doing better than their neighbors. So they're the place that people come for the shopping and for the hospital, the regional hospital, and so forth. The other thing that they have is a medium security prison.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems like an odd thing to hang your town's future on.
But it's a stable employer, you said.
It's a stable employer, and it brings a lot of people into town. I was so surprised. I never would have thought that. So there you are, you know, 300 miles from Kansas City or whatever it is. And there are men who are incarcerated, and that's where their families are, in Kansas City.
Wow.
And so weekends or holidays or whatever, well, guess what? Whole groups of people traipse out to Norton to spend time with their incarcerated family member. And that brings lots of interesting dynamics to the town.
Yeah. Tell us about one man you met there. His name is Aaron Hale, who was a native of Norton and left and then came back, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, he did. And he went to school at KU. He had been in the National Guard, and so had done some time in some military service. He had worked for several different kind of technology companies. I believe he lived in Kansas City he lived in Lawrence for a time and possibly Kansas City, and worked for a couple of different companies and layoffs and one thing or another. But he was, you know, sort of stable. And he and his wife, she wasn't from Norton, but she might have even been from Cottonwood Falls, if I'm remembering correctly. Mm-hmm. But they just said one day, you know what? Why don't we go back? Why don't we move back out there? My folks are still farming. They could use the help. We have kids now. We like the small schools. We like the environment out there. We feel that the conservative, I suppose, values are more in keeping with, you know, what we are experiencing in the Kansas City area. Let's just go back. And so that's what they've done. And he is very active in the community and in economic development, volunteerism. But he did say to me, you know, I just miss having that Home Depot 2 blocks down from where I live to make those quick trips, because now he doesn't have that. It's an hour, you know, to a place like that. But, you know, if you live in a big city, you trade things off, as you mentioned at the top. My belief is that the borders are porous in the world that we live in today. People can perceive of themselves as being mobile in a way that I don't think that they used to.
That's interesting.
And so if they want to go to Topeka for the day and, you know, say, God, I'm so glad I'm out of there now. It was fun, but now I'm home in my small town, then fine. You know, it makes people have even more broader choices than they might have perceived to have had.
Julianne Couch's new book, The Small Town Midwest, Resilience and Hope in the 21st Century. Thanks for taking some time with us.
You are so welcome.
Appreciate it.
Bye, Steve.
Coming up now, Bill Brownlee in this week's Local Listen. KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is here and wants to talk about a group that's doing some interesting things. The group is the Philistines. How are you, Bill?
I'm well, Steve.
Tell us about the Philistines.
The Philistines is a Kansas City rock and roll band with a difference, and that difference being that they're a little bit older than the musicians that usually play rock and roll in Kansas City. These are men and women in their 30s and 40s.
They're old. They're really old.
So they're ancient.
They're ancient.
but one reason I have always been so high on the Philistines is that younger musicians, I've noticed, who play rock and roll are kind of sheepish about it. Like, because hip-hop and electronic dance music are so popular now, the younger musicians who choose rock and roll, you know, are almost apologetic about the way they go about it. The Philistines aren't like that. They truly believe in what they're doing, and they're old enough to remember a time when rock and roll was actually popular.
Let's listen to the Philistines. This is Radiation Drive from their 2016 album, The Backbone of Night. Maybe it's because they're older, but I like that song. Sounds pretty good. It's old music.
It's music for old people.
But it's spacey. There's a vintage quality to it, too.
Yeah, I hear a little David Bowie, maybe some Mata Hoople and T-Rex and groups like that. This is an eight-minute song. Something, again, that you know, younger musicians might not be comfortable with, but the Philistines are comfortable enough to stretch things out.
Monique Gabriel Salazar said in a review for KCUR that the band exudes an effortless postmodern confidence, relishing in symphonious sound with creepy embellishments. That sound about right to you? That's a hell of a sense.
Yeah, it is. It's a little creepy, you know, in a good way. There's nothing ironic about what the Philistines are doing here. And when they perform, as they will, at the Ship this weekend, you know, they'll jump around and, you know, get the audience involved. And it's creepy in the best sense of the word.
I'm only a little familiar with the Ship. I've been there a couple of times. Tell us about it.
The Ship is a hidden gem in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. You know, the people who go there typically either go there once or make it their regular hangout. It's a hidden dive, kind of like a speakeasy. Yet it feels like a secret when you're there. I highly recommend KCR listeners track it down.
They'll be there on Saturday. The Philistines will be. This track again, Radiation Drive from the Philistines' 2016 album, The Backbone of Night. Great pick, Bill. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve.
Follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. On tomorrow's show, it's grillin' time. We'll check out the best Kansas City-style backyard recipes just in time for the 4th of July. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.